Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Shift, the podcast that aims to tell the no-holds-barred truth about being a woman post-40. Created and hosted by me, writer and broadcaster Sam Baker. My guest today is the actor-screenwriter-comedian-novelist, all the hyphens, Andy Osho. You might recognise her from Line of Duty or Blue Lights. She's all over the place. And as if that's not enough, in her previous incarnation as a stand-up comedian, she won the Funny Women Award. Now she's turned her hand to fiction. Her new book, Tough Crowd, is a laugh-out-loud romantic comedy about a subject that's very close to my heart. What it means to be a step-parent, or sparent, as she calls it, which I think is absolutely brilliant.
You know, when I look back on these situations, I'm just like, wow, I really did not think that through. I got myself into something that was massive, and I kept thinking, how hard can it be?
Andy joined me to talk about being a teenage dork, how getting back in touch with her estranged dad gave her renewed respect for her mum, and giving herself permission to be creative. She also told me about checking in with your heart, why it's okay to mourn your younger self, and how she realised she didn't want kids, but she did want a family. Let's go back. Can you tell me a little bit about little Andy? Because I saw you describe yourself as someone who loved maths and being in the choir, which just seemed like, particularly the maths bit, it seemed like such a, my prejudices, like I didn't think a maths person would be a comedian and writer.
Yeah. So I liked school for up until a certain point. I really liked school. I really liked getting homework. I remember asking for homework at one point. I mean, that stopped when I became a teenager.
But yeah, totally.
Yeah. So and the choir was like different because the whole liking maths and all that and liking homework, that was basically up until about 11. And then I sort of this kind of cynicism set in around 11, 12 years old, where I just felt like, what's the point? And I think that basically what had happened is that I'd been let down by, you know, a friend that I thought was like my best friend, basically. And she kind of dumped me for cooler kids. And I'm not blaming her, but the impact on me, because I was a very sensitive kid. And sometimes when I look back, things that I think happened to me might not have been actually as bad, but they felt bad because of how sensitive a kid I was. And so finding the choir was finding that safe space, you know, like where you could be a complete dork and love maths. And in the choir environment, we were just this collection of various expressions of dork, and we loved each other. And we were, you know, the kind of this little family. But I think what was more important about it that we didn't realize at the time, it was kind of a safe space. to be all those things where you couldn't be outside in a normal run of school.
Yeah, I mean, when you're at school, it's like dork is the worst possible thing to be, isn't it? And it doesn't make any difference when you've got grown-ups going, oh, like when you're older, it'll be fine. You'll be the one who ends up on top, you know, all of that. Because when you're like 10 or 11 or 12, you don't really care if you're going to be on top when you're 30. You just want to be on top for the rest of the day, or just not on the bottom.
Yeah, like 30 is just a total abstraction for a 13-year-old. It's just like, what even is 30? Do you know what I mean? I'm like, that's a whole more than my lifetime, you know, the length of my already lifetime away. Like, it doesn't mean anything. And the funny thing is like a lot of the people that were the quote-unquote dorky kids, is they're always so much more interesting in adulthood compared to whoever was the popular, you know, were the popular kids. But again, that's irrelevant when you are that kid at 12, full of angst and, you know, just wanting to read manga comics and hide it from people.
Oh, God, anybody seeing you reading a manga comic? Like, whoa, Jesus. It's like you like maths and you read manga comics. Like,
yeah, exactly. I mean, I didn't, but do you know what I mean? Like, that, those are the sort of like niche worlds that kids like that would be into and it not be accepted. And I suppose there is a thing of like teenagers' consciousnesses developing and not being fully developed so that their worlds are small and they're, you know, their priorities are different. And so we as adults can turn around and say, listen, it's all going to be better when you're 30. But they haven't got the capacity to get that. I mean, we can try saying it and then hopefully they'll look back at some point and go, oh yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Oh God. I just won't go back for anything. Do you think that being in that choir and finding like a, I don't know whether home is the right word, but like say safe space there, do you think that shaped your wanting to go into acting and onto the stage?
I think that was already there, like before the choir. I didn't join the dots between that being a creative expression and then, because the acting actually came along quite a bit later. So I left school at 16. I just couldn't wait to get away from that particular environment. And so I went and did my A-levels in a sort of college, further education college, and a lot of my friends went there, friends from school went there as well. But then after that, my higher education was at a place called Ravensbourne, which at the time focused on design and like making TV shows and stuff like that. So I learned to be behind the camera did like 2 year HND. And then spent 10 years working in post-production. So that's like all the editing and all the bits that happen after a show's been shot. But it's very behind, it's further behind the camera. It's not even behind the camera. It's behind the people behind the camera. You know what I mean? It was so far back. And so I stayed in that environment working in various companies for about 10 years until it just got to the point where I was just like, I like this. It appeals to that logical part of my brain. Because I was basically kind of like an operations manager, bookings person in various places. So it was all about organizing people. It was like booking people, putting people and equipment in the right place at the right time for the right client. And then I was like, yeah, that appeals to the part of me that likes maths and spreadsheets. But there was a part of me, like a creative part of me that I was beginning to realize was unsatisfied. I hadn't even acknowledged it like up until that point. And then, yeah, I was just really feeling like there was something else that needed to be serviced within me that this job would never, no matter how high I got, no matter, you know, I suppose ultimately you end up running your own company. That's probably where something like that, the job I was doing would lead. It was never going to satisfy that creative part of me. I wanted to make things. And so I was working in an environment where there was, you know, a lot of actors. Because we were all working on this soap. And so the actors and the production and the post-production, we were all in the same place. So I got to know some of the actors and I was like, oh, I think that's what I want to do. Oh God. It was like coming out. It's like, oh, I'm going to start telling people, you know, you don't want to be an actor. Oh, we love you, whatever you are. and I didn't even know how to do it. I didn't know. I wasn't really aware that drama school was the route. I'm just going to give this a go. And my mindset was, I'm going to try it. And if it fails, at least I can say I tried it. That's all I want, is to be able to have tried. And I felt like once I figured out the whole drama school thing, I felt like I was too old. I was 29 and I'd already decided I was too old to go to drama school. I didn't have enough time to waste, quote unquote, doing that. So I just sort of went for it and started doing like lots of short courses and workshops and stuff like that. So I knew I had to get an education in this field, in this craft, but I didn't want to commit to like a 3-year training thing. I didn't have the money for it either. And so that's kind of how I started.
So you said just now when you said that going kind of behind the people, behind the camera was the safe option. Was that safe? Who's safe? Was it like pleasing? Was it like the thing that would make your mum not worry? Was it?
I wasn't consciously thinking that, but I realised that the environment that I grew up in was not one that encouraged risk. You know, we weren't encouraged to consider an entrepreneurial life or a freelance life or a creative life because it was too uncertain. All our education at home was geared towards going towards 9-to-5 safety, a profession, not just a job, a profession. So my oldest brother is an architect and my next brother down he was a senior accountant within the NHS. It's a good solid, you know what I mean? You can work anywhere with those skills. You can work in other countries as long as you can convert or whatever. But do you know what I mean? That's good solid.
I can hear your mum saying that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if she actually said it, but like definitely that was implied in our upbringing, strongly implied, let's say.
So when you came out as a wannabe actor, how did that go down?
Yeah. You know, my mum is very supportive, but I think a lot of it didn't quite make sense. So I think she was kind of referencing off how I'm feeling, how am I doing? And if I'm happy, then it seems to be, this is how I watch shows that I don't understand, like industry or something like that. Like I don't understand all the financial talk, but if that character is unhappy and that one is happy, then I know what's going on. And I think that's what my mum was doing with me is like, she seems to be enjoying this. And then, you know, she came to see some shows, but the first thing I was in was just this sort of terrible show. And it's funny because you know, she was well done, terribly proud. And then I invited her to see, I was in a show, Pinocchio, a revival of Pinocchio. And she was like, oh, no, I don't think so. And then I was thinking, cool. Do you think in the all plays and like these really confronting, like male nudity front taking, you know, even though it was like Pinocchio. And she's like, no, I'm good. Thank you. I've had enough dicks. for my liking. Yeah. So she was very supportive. But I think where she struggled was, you know, my financial instability that came from making this choice. That was very difficult, I think, for her to see. And then it was difficult emotionally because when I went to America, I've had this feeling, I know I'm supposed to be there, but I don't know why. So we would often have conversations where I was quite upset, quite tearful, but the solution was not come home as far as I was concerned, you know. So she would have to, you know, try and figure out how to best support me when the one logical thing, you know, knowing how important logic is in our family, the one logical thing to do would be, all right, take yourself out of this environment that is upsetting you. I think with my mum, as long as we're all happy, she's happy. She just wants to see us content in whatever it is we're doing. It doesn't mean she hasn't got an opinion about like what makes sense and what doesn't, but she's not one of those parents that's enforcing that on you.
She sounds pretty amazing. Did you go to America for, went to America to go to LA and try your luck?
Yeah, basically. I mean.
Oh my God, you're such a glutton for punishment.
I know, right? So, where that came from was really depression, actually. So I had got quite a long way down the road with the old stand-up career and stuff. And, you know, I'd done my Apollos and little Mock the Weeks. And I was just really starting to get disenchanted with the whole thing and feeling like this chasm between who I had to be on stage and who I was in my life. I don't know, maybe because I was doing a bit of work on myself or whatever, but I just felt less and less wanting to go on stage. And then, you know, I got really depressed. I remember one evening just Googling, like, living in America or working in America or something like that, or working in Hollywood. That was it. And then this course came up, or this kind of networking event sort of thing, where this guy takes you out to Hollywood, and he introduces you to actors and agents and managers and agents and things like that. I was like, is this a hoax? It sounds too good to be true, because there were all these really great testimonies. And I kept looking up, I Googled the name of his event, and then scam and hoax and stuff like that. So I went, and it was a real struggle, because I was so deep in the depression that I almost left. I got to LA, and then I was like, I can't do this. I can't be around people. I don't want to network. This is not where my head's at. And I changed my flight, and I told the guy, listen, I'm really sorry. I know you don't do refunds and all the rest of it, but I'm going home. And he was like, please don't go home. You are really going to regret going home. And it was the most amazing week. And I made friends for life, you know, on that course. And so I ended up just like doing a bunch of different stuff. I ended up staying in the end for like 6 years, and I would like, I was trying to be a vlogger, and then I'm going to be a director, and I made short films. And I think ultimately the reason that I went to LA was not to make it. It was to learn and give myself permission to be an artist. Cause when I came back with a lot more self-belief and faith in my craft and my artistry, kind of thing. Because before leaving, I did feel like how people saw me was so limited. And it's not that just being a stand-up is anything wrong with that. If that is all you want to do and that's how people see you, then great. Public perception is in alignment with who you are. But that wasn't me. I had more to give, more I wanted to do. And so therefore public perception was completely out of alignment with who and what but I was buying into it by continuing only on that track. So giving myself going to America, that gave me that sort of career interruption. I don't know, reinvent it in a way, really. It sounds a bit poncy, really. I went to America to reinvent myself. But like, it was a little bit like that, of just broadening who and what I was.
It takes a lot of courage to do that, doesn't it, though? Because you had gone from, you know, behind the scenes to stand up. And then you're like, okay, well, I did that and I enjoyed it for a while, but now it's not, I don't know, feeding me or meeting my needs, or it's not making me feel great. So I'm going to step back from that again. But is that something that you've always had, or is it something you've acquired as you've got older?
You mean like stepping back from an opportunity because it doesn't feel right, like almost like an intuition about your
like a clear sightedness about what you need, and then the courage to go, well, yeah, it's a risk, but I'm going to do it.
No, I don't think I have always had it. In fact, I thought I was quite risk averse actually growing up, which is why I chose the Ravensbourne option as opposed to. You know, some of my peers did go off to drama school. So it's not like I didn't have like real world examples of people doing it, but I just honestly did not think it was for people like me. That's what the story that I told myself. And I didn't even really know what I meant by people like me, because the, you know, a couple of people that I'm thinking of were Black. So it wasn't like a race thing. It was just, maybe it was a combination of things, growing up in the East End and working class family, you know, maybe it was a lot of different things, but yeah, I just didn't think that was an option. When I got to the precipice of like deciding I wanted to go into acting, I think that was that thing of just like, this has to happen. I have to do this. And it's not a willfulness. It's not a, no matter what, no matter whether there's advice, you know, good advice to the contrary, I'm doing this. It's not like that. It was more like just feeling your way through. And I sometimes think of, you know, your heart as like this compass that is, you know, will always take you to your true north. So if you check in with yourself, you'll always get directed in the right way of where you're supposed to be. And so I suppose I hope that's what I'm doing, is like feeling my way through and going, How does my heart feel about this? Well, my heart's not in it. Well, in that case, it means that I'm not, it's not the right place for me. As much as, I mean, one of my friends is also a comedian. He just says it's really funny because it's like, it's almost like, he says it's almost like I clocked the game of stand-up. It's like, you know, doing, getting to the pinnacle, UK stand-up anyways, doing live at the Apollo. So it's like, right, clock that game. What game shall I play now? And I wasn't thinking of it like that, but I what actually happened is I was looking down the road at people who are further ahead than me, and I wasn't excited about what they were doing. So I thought, well, if that's what's down the road for me and I'm not excited about it, why carry on down this road? There's nothing there for me that's going to fill me up, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? Because so often the problem is that you can't see any, I don't want to use the word role models, what's the word? But you kind of, you look up and you can't see anyone who looks like you. But actually, if you're looking up and you can see a path, but that you don't want to take that path. That's like one, how old do you think you were when you started checking in with your heart and then listening to what your heart said?
Yeah, listening. That's the key, isn't it? Is like actually paying attention. You know, it's hard to know because I might have been doing it and not been aware that I was doing it. But I think probably the conscious one was the going into acting, you know, and like leaving the relative safety of, because I became, towards the end of my time working behind the camera, I sort of became a contractor. So leaving that last contract, like letting that finish basically, and then going, right, that's it. I have to make a choice now. That was a hard decision because it wasn't logical. I could have taken another contract and worked in the theater in the evenings and done something bonkers like that. But at least I would have had a regular income. But I just felt that, you know, I had to put my lack of money where my mouth is, I guess, because it was like all like, you know what I mean, like temping and, oh my God, that's when I had some of my worst jobs of like being a tequila girl and working in a bar. And I, you know, the crazy thing is I was doing teenagers' jobs basically at 30.
Oh God, that is, yeah, that makes stand up, like given the choice between that and getting up on a stage and being booed off. It's like, I'll take the being booed off, thanks, any day of the week. In Tough Crowd, your main character, Abby, it starts with a routine, her stand-up routine, which is about being too much. Mm. Is that something that you identified with, kind of growing up, growing into yourself?
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I feel like a boy with lots of energy isn't considered a strange thing, but a girl who has lots of energy gets given labels like tomboy or too much or, you know, all this sort of stuff. And so I think that it was important for me to have Abby B have this too much experience and go on a journey with it because it's so like under the current of society in terms of how we relate to young women, young girls. But it is so unhealthy as well, because actually who's to say what's too much? Maybe you're not enough. And actually Abby says that at one point, but she doesn't really believe it at the point that she says it. But yeah, it's like, who's defining this too muchness?
Yeah, it's like, who's making the rules? It's the same. It's the whole thing, isn't it? Like when women are angry, they're like shrill or hysterical. And when men are angry, they're powerful. And it's just all of those kind of rules that we all learn when we're really young, I suppose.
Oh, definitely. 100%. I mean, I sometimes joke, like, you know, who did men get to do their PR? Because it's perfect, you know, because we're all convinced by the fact, by the idea that women are more emotional, because men have managed to trick her, or, you know, generally speaking, we've all been managed to trick us into thinking that anger isn't an emotion, or jealousy isn't an emotion, or rage isn't an emotion. Not that, you know, those are only the preserves of men, but they feel like socially acceptable expressions of men's emotions, whereas pretty much all of women's emotions are unacceptable unless they are like, you know, looking completely divine and feminine while doing it. You know, sort of Demi Moore single tear in Ghost is acceptable.
Oh yes, just one tear.
One big fat tear.
Trickling.
Yeah. We're ugly crying. No, you're hysterical. Oh, that's wrong.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Your dad left when you were 7.
Yeah.
Didn't he? How old were your brothers then?
So they would have been probably about 13 and 14, something like that. So they're quite close in age.
Did having older brothers, did that kind of offset it a little bit or not?
No, not really. I think we were all having our own singular experiences of it. What I realised only recently, that the ages that we were at when it happened really affect how we perceive what happened, as well as our own personal relationship with him. So, and this only came to the fore because I got in touch with him. I was having therapy again, and the therapist was like, we need to reconnect you with your dad.
How did that feel when the therapist said that?
It was interesting because I didn't see how that related to what I was going through. Because I think, this was when the depression started. And so I had never thought to myself, I'm depressed because I've lost contact with my dad. That's not what I thought was going on. I didn't know why I was depressed, but she was like, yes, you need to reconnect with your dad. So it took about probably a month or so to actually get maybe even longer, but to physically have a number for him. And then, a little while longer to actually decide that I was going to call him. And it was a very amusing conversation in the sense of, like, it wasn't the sort of emotional outpouring that you might, you might romanticize in a moment like this. It was like, can you hear me now? Because he's in Nigeria. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? How about now? It was like probably like that. I was, exuberant. I was like, I've reconnected with my dad, and I had this really visceral physical experience of like circuitry completing inside of me, and all the lots of things made sense about my past and who I am and who I'd become and blah-de-blah. Blah. Anywho, so I told my mum, breathlessly telling her all this thing. She's like, oh, right, okay. And I told her some things that I'd found out about him that were a bit of a shock. And so, yeah, there was that. I mean, sidebar. So she's just written her autobiography, and I offered to edit it. And so, yeah, so there's all these gaps that are now getting filled in of like all these things that I sort of knew about my dad, but didn't. But because I'm editing her book, not only am I reading it, but I'm also having to ask questions as well. Okay, so mum, how long was dad in prison for? like stuff like that. So yeah, like finding out, I mean, I knew about that, but I didn't realize how long and where and why it had happened. I never really asked. And so this is the first time in my life I've really had a more comprehensive understanding of the family history especially like prior to us as well. Like what's my mum's origin story, basically?
I mean, you were 7 when you'd last seen him. And how old were you when you found him? Like 37?
Yeah, so 30, oh gosh, it was 2012. So what would that be? So I'd be 40. I was nearly 40.
Nearly 40. Wow. Really? So you hadn't seen him for 23 years.
So we had seen him. We had seen him in between. So he had randomly shown up on our door one evening when I was probably about 11. And then we had gone to Nigeria and seen him then a couple of times. I think the last time I saw him was, I think he came to the UK again, and I was like in my very early 20s. So it's probably like a good 20 years since I had spoken to him.
And how did his leaving shape you, do you think?
So this is conjecture purely, because who can know? But I think that it made me a really hard person. Basically, I think when things happen to you in childhood, you create strong suits, you create defense mechanisms, you create coping mechanisms to deal with it. You don't realize that's what you're doing, but you're trying to basically stay safe in the world. So mine was armoring up. And so I was a very defensive person, very volatile emotionally, but they were male emotions, you know, anger and snapping at people and stuff. I was very competitive, like to the point where I get angry almost if somebody beat me at something. I remember playing pool with a boyfriend. I was furious that he beat me afterwards. And it was just like, he's like, that wasn't fun. doing things like that with me just was not fun, because I could get so deeply competitive. Yeah, I would freeze people out if I, like, just not to stop talking to them. If I was upset about something, I would never express myself, express my emotions. I found that very, very difficult. I was very difficult in relationships. So I think all of those, I'm not blaming my dad, but I think a lot of that came from the armoring up or the, you know, coping mechanisms as a result of him not being there. But it was also probably, you know, it was probably as a result of a reaction to who my mum was becoming. Because I remember my experience of her was that she was very soft and gentle prior to him leaving, and that she wasn't afterwards. And so I think that I had unconsciously made choices. And I do remember having an experience where I said to myself, oh, wow, I'm on my own here. Like about 10 or 11. That's very young to make a decision like that. Fuck you. I'm just like, I was getting picked on at school and somebody had upset me, like teasing me about my Nigerian name. And that happened a lot with foreign names. As we all know, like people find ways to do all kinds of things with them. And I was upset and I was crying in my bedroom, and my mum sort of banged on the wall, because there was a wall between us. We were in adjacent sort of rooms. And I told her what was wrong. She was like, is that it? That is it, lady. That
is exactly not enough for you.
Yeah. What do you need? Blood? I didn't have any of those thoughts. It was just such a gut punch. I was just like, you're on your own. That was
the thing. Yeah.
Like, you're just nobody has your back. And I'm not saying that she's
not
didn't.
On your team.
Yeah. I'm not saying she didn't. And from her perspective, like, given the things that she's been through, something like that just wouldn't register as being, upsetting. So I don't think she's a bad person for like having thought that. But from that 10-year-old's perspective of what she needed from her mama and what she got, oh my God, it was devastating.
Do you think that, not to psychoanalyze you, promise, but do you think that combination of your dad leaving and that experience you just recounted with your mum, do you think that affected your relationships going forward, like your relationships with men, where you were a bit like, I'm an island almost?
I was completely, and I mean, in hindsight, impenetrably so. I mean, yeah. Anyway, but you know, I was not emotionally really available, because I always metaphorically have my bags packed, because people leave you. You know, that's the lesson I've been taught. And I think that's the other thing about, you know, when you're a kid, is the lessons that you get taught by how, because people forget how much kids learn by what adults do rather than what they say. And so what his actions were was just fucking up and leave. Like, you don't even have to say, because he didn't say anything. He didn't say, in fact, he duped my mum into thinking that we were all moving to Nigeria and he just didn't come back. He didn't call. She was like tearing her hair out. Where is he? Where is he? Is everything okay? Because he was like, I'll go out first. I'll come back with you guys' tickets. And my mum was shipping our stuff over. You know, do you know what I mean? It was like that level of deceit. And so the lesson, but from his behavior for me as a kid was, oh, you just leave. You just vacate. And so that's what I did emotionally sometimes with people. I think that's what that was, that shutting down of just like not giving anything. But also, you know, like in a relationship, I just sometimes just wasn't there. It was just like either unproductive emotions were there or there was nothing there. I'm fine. No, I'm fine. You know, like that type. So you have to, this is why I had to do work. You know what I mean? Like some people are, oh, you're working. Blah, blah, blah. I had to. I would have been a monstrous grown up if I hadn't. I mean, yeah, gosh.
Because I noticed that the dreadful mum in Tough Crowd, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. She talks about Abby as basically not having any of the grown-up responsibilities of that her sister has, like the kids and the husband, and I noticed that you don't.
I mean, partly choice, mostly choice, but also a little bit circumstances. It's always a little bit circumstances, or not always. Anyways, in my situation, it's a little bit. I thought I wanted kids because that was the model that was laid out. And then I was with somebody who didn't want kids. And then at that point, I really did want kids. And so we broke up. And then afterwards, I started to think, well, for a while, I was desperate to meet somebody really quickly afterwards, because just simply because I wanted to have kids. And then as I was approaching 40, I started thinking, if you're quite an intentional person, like when you say you're going to do something, you always do it. You always do it. So why haven't you had kids? Maybe it's not about kids. And then I was thinking, what is it about? I was like, it's family. That's what I was actually wanting. Family is very different from having kids. Family could be a friendship group. Family could be you and your dog. Family can be just you and a partner. You can adopt, you can foster, you can, you know what I mean? It's like, and the relief that I got from that realization was immense, because it just stopped the chase. Because I was almost frantic, like almost like sometimes I liken myself to Predator looking for that skull. No, it's not you. It's not you. Who is this person who's going to give me family? And so the relief of not having to look for that person anymore, especially as, you know, because I've got the biological clock, not just ticking, but like gonging in my ears kind of thing. So not having to worry about that was a massive relief. But also the reason that Abby has no kids as well is because that was the situation that I found myself in with the people that I dated that did have kids that I was drawing on as an example. I think it's a very specific situation in the step parenting model where you don't have kids yourself, because it's different if you're both bringing kids to the blended environment. But if you're a single child-free woman dating a guy with kids, man, that is a totally different ask, because you're still in the question of, do I want kids? Can I have kids? I don't actually know. Like a lot of times you don't know. And so emotionally, it's a different landscape, basically. So that's why I wanted that that dynamic for Abby and Will.
Yeah, I think people talk about it so little, because I'm a stepmom and I was 26 when I got my stepson. For me, I always felt like I was completely out of sync with my peers, because I was suddenly kind of projected into this situation where I was not a mum in any stretch. I was never that. And I think the word you use, sparent, is absolutely brilliant, because that's exactly what you are. You're like extra. You're another person in that sort of role. But it was really, it's like, oh, wow. So all of a sudden, none of my friends have got kids. And then as my stepson became an adult, all of my friends had little kids. So I was always in a real out of sync situation. And that kind of, also all that kind of stigma around, particularly the stepmother, Like, I think there's a really something I've written it down. I can't find it. Oh, yeah, they're always old and they have big noses and they hate girls. It just really, really made me laugh.
Yeah. That, I mean, that's it, isn't it? That's how they're portrayed. And it's just like, wow, that's not how Abby saw herself. But also, why is it like that? Like, what? Why is that the perception that people have of these people? And yeah, so I really wanted to look at that because it's a particular emotional ask of women. I think for myself, I was just massively naive about what I was getting into. I really, really didn't think it through. And so I've gone to great lengths to change a lot of the detail because it really isn't about the guy or the kids. It's about the journey that I went on. And so I've given Abby all these, you know, different details, and the stand-up is not what I was doing at the time and all that, because yeah, it's really about her journey. You know, when I look back on these situations, I'm just like, wow, I really did not think that through. I got myself into something that was massive, and I kept thinking, how hard can it be? We'll be fine. And making all these assumptions about, like, you know, Abby has a moment where she's like, what are the kids going to call me? And Will's like, Abby. And I had a similar thing. It wasn't about what they're going to call me, but I remember the guy, they were looking for a new school for their kid. And I was like, I should have a bit of a say in this, don't you think? And he was like, what? No, it's got nothing to do with you. I mean, he didn't say it like that, but it's just like, what?
Yeah, it's like, I think there are so many things, isn't there, like, that are probably, that they become true and they're not necessarily true, they're just true for you. I think I'm going to adopt sparent because I think that's what you are.
Yeah, you're falling between so many different stools. Because I remember having to, well, you know, the guy I was with and the oldest, they had a little bit of a falling out, and so there was a bit of stomping off to bedrooms and stuff. And I wanted to console the eldest, and he didn't want to talk to me. And I was kind of like, I'm not his mum to be able to say. To persist, basically. I had to let it go. So it's a really, really tricky space to be in. But I guess, I hope, rewarding for folks as well to stick with it and just allow themselves to grow in the role.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely consider myself really lucky. I mean, that's my family, you know.
Yeah. And I also, it was important to me as well, and I hope this comes across, that I wanted Elle to be, you know, at first blush, she might appear to be the villain, but she's not. She's really in pain herself. And so, and she is a child learning how to express herself and dealing with this brand new adult that dad has not forced on them, but he hasn't maybe proceeded with the care that he should have. And so, you know, she expresses herself in a particular way, but I want her to be, you know, obviously three-dimensional and not people to not, they might dislike what she does, but I don't want them to hate her.
No, totally. I don't think they will. I don't think they will. So where are you at now? You're 50, aren't you now? And you look fantastic. Not that that's relevant to anything, but you do. How is life now for Andy at 50?
I think it's much more settled. And I also think, you know, we were talking about this whole navigating by heart. I think actually I am doing that a bit more consciously now of like, what is the right next step for me? What do I really want as well? Like really checking in with myself quite regularly and asking that question, like what do I want that's from my spirit? And what are the wants that are just ego wants? And they're often not the same. And the spirit often just wants to be settled and content and secure and is comfortable with uncertainty in a way that the ego isn't. So it's like really like taking a beat to go, all right, what actually is really there in terms of what you want? So there's a bit more of that. Life's a lot quieter now. And what I've noticed with turning 50, so I just turned 50 earlier in the year, is kind of, you know, I'm definitely conscious now of the aging process. I think I was like 40 for like 10 years, essentially. And then suddenly I became 50. And it's different. It's really different. what I'm sort of conscious of at the moment is mourning, allowing myself to grieve who I was. Because I remember I did a sort of very brief Marianne Williamson workshop about aging. And I think that came up is this notion of like grieving the person that you were, because that can be part of what can cause sort of depression and mental health issues with the sort of aging process, is not realizing that you're now in a different phase of life. Your attractiveness will change, but that doesn't dictate your worth. Do you know what I mean? Like, I used to be a hot son, like in my 30s with the legs out and the little dresses and the blah, blah, blah. That girl doesn't exist anymore. Those legs are gone. But my value hasn't lessened, but I have to have a little bit of a remember that it's sad for me actually that that's not who I am anymore. You know, I can look good, but it's that look good for your age thing. It's not the, you know what I mean, objective 30 something, fit legs, you know, banging body, all the rest of it. It's not, people don't relate to me in that way anymore. And as much as I do my sort of try and do my interior work to, you know, be present to my value in different ways, society is still very reverential of youth, isn't it? So like, it's not, we all have to start to agree that youth isn't all that before, you know, the messaging will really start to change. Like even just stopping dyeing my hair and cutting it felt like a real massive, like act of almost like a revolutionary act. And that it took me probably about 4 years to get to that decision to be able to do it. It was not an overnight thing. But yeah, so 50 looks a bit like really getting comfortable in my own skin. You know, the messaging from outside isn't necessarily that this isn't the best to be in. You know, so I have to, so now it becomes work, because it's easy if you're young and hot to go, oh, I'm just comfortable with my skin, or because everybody loves your fucking skin. Everybody loves hot.
Yeah.
It's more work when it's 50 and the skin is a bit sort of, you know, crepey.
I noticed that a couple of the people I've spoken to who, like one who was a scriptwriter, and she had been told by her agent, basically she was 49. You're 49. You are basically 49 indefinitely. You are basically a female scriptwriter, can't be 50. I was like, wow. And then I spoke to a comedian, and when I started talking about her age, she was like, well, she started making like cutting note motions at me. And then she's about the same age as me, so like mid 50s. And I was like, and she's like a real like box smasher, rule breaker, take no prisoners. And she was like, no, we don't talk about my age. And I was like, and I didn't say it, but at the time I thought, wow, you're the person who breaks all the rules, but not that rule. Have you felt like any pressure professionally to like stick at late 40s?
No. but that is because industry is slowly changing to have better representation. So if we were 20 years ago, yeah, I would have definitely, I would still be dyeing my hair. I would be 45 indefinitely. And, you know, I would have been giving you the cut, cut, cut signal for talking about my age. But I think we're in a new world now where there is much better representation and much more diversity in terms of how a role is perceived. So a senior surgeon can now look like me. A head teacher can now look like me. A senior police officer can now look like me. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, you're looking at a script and people, even in the writing stage, were not perceiving these characters to be looking anything other than white men, basically. Even women, you know, white women were being sort of like cut out of the picture. So it's made it easier now. And actually, funny enough, there were some roles that I wasn't getting because I didn't look old enough. A senior, whatnot, a head of, you know, obs gynae or something. I wouldn't get a look in because I was, you know, I might have been late 40s, but I looked early 40s or late 30s or something like that, which is, thanks, guys, but I really want this job. So letting my grays come out and cutting my hair and all that and discussing my age, it's not strategic, but I don't think it's going to hinder me. And If it does, then what needs to change is industry perception rather than me feeling like, oh, I shouldn't talk about it. I shouldn't tell anybody I'm 50. It's like, I'm 50. Just you adjust, because 50 happens to everybody. And you should be grateful if you get that far, because some people don't make it that far, you know? So why are we demonizing like these ages?
Totally. I've had so much of your time. I'm just going to quickly ask you the questions that I always ask at the end, and then I'll free you. But thank you. What's your emotional age?
Oh, what a good question. I think it is 50.
Would you, if I'd asked you that question, say a year ago, obviously you would have been 49, but would you have said that, or has that changed, has that solidified in the last year?
Yeah, I think that if you'd asked me a year ago, it probably would have been sort of early 40s. I think something profound happened when I turned 50. Like I could feel, it felt like a different phase of life. I even said to a friend the other day, I mean, you know, at my age, and she just went, what do you even mean by that? I was like, she's 10 years younger than me. I was like, this is real. This is a real thing.
Yeah. Give us a book recommendation. So it can be something that you've like always loved, or it can just be something great you read lately, anything.
So something that I enjoyed recently is Mrs. Death, Mrs. Death.
Love that.
Yeah.
She's been on the pod. Selena.
Oh my God. Now I found it really challenging, and it's not something that I would have picked up in a bookstore. So I was reading it because I was doing a show where we were going to be discussing it. I loved it. I was just so transported by her inventiveness and obviously the poetry in it, and the talking about death. I think getting to 50, you think about death. And I loved that she had so much to say about it. And it was out there because we shy away from death. We're scared of death, and we shouldn't be, because it is part of life. It gives life context. So we can't shy away from these conversations. So I really love that there's this like beautiful book about it.
What advice would you give younger women?
Younger women? I thought you could say younger self. I was like, well, she wouldn't listen anyway.
That's probably true still, though, of all younger women.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's dare to take up space, because I think when I was scared to take up space, and I noticed something relatively recently, that when I used to walk down the street up until not that long ago, I would sort of check in with the person I was passing. Am I okay with you? And that is a strange thing to do, like to not be, to be so like unsure of your, of how appropriate it is for you to take up space, that you're checking in with strangers. Is this okay? Is it okay that I exist?
I feel sad for little Andy.
Yeah, well, it wasn't little Andy. It was adult Andy. Right up into my 30s, I was still doing that. I mean, in my teens, I was terrified. I hated walking past bus stops because I thought everyone was staring at me and everyone was talking about me. But like, yeah, certainly up until I'd say mid-30s or something, like am I okay with you? And obviously people have got like really sort of resting faces that don't look particularly available. So I would always think, no, I'm not. I'm not okay with them. I'm not okay with that person either. Oh my God, the world hates me.
That's like hyper alertness, isn't it?
When you live in a household where you feel like you have to walk on eggshells, as you become hyper alert as an adult. And that is better than it used to be. But yeah, it was something that has been part of my sort of makeup, is being hyper alert about other people's emotions.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
States.
Who is your old bird role model?
I sometimes think to myself, if I'm being a bit full of it, I think, would Oprah say that?
Like, would she would. Yeah.
Well, a lot of times she wouldn't. The things that I'm thinking of, she's not very, she doesn't brag. She's not a braggy type of person. She doesn't humble brag. If she's going to say something about herself, she just says it. You know, I am the, you know, one of the most successful, you know, TV hosts and entrepreneurs in my field. And I've done this, that, and the other. She'd just say it. She wouldn't feel a way of going, well, I guess I suppose I've done well. And I often use Oprah and Brad Pitt, weirdly. Like, those are the two. Like, I go, Brad Pitt say that. He doesn't strike me as a sort of braggy type of person either. So I use those two as a model of like, am I being full of it or am I trying to do a humble brag? And then I put it in Oprah's mouth or Brad Pitt's mouth. And if it doesn't feel right, then I don't say it.
I'm totally going to try that. But that, do you know what? That strikes me as really interesting because what Oprah doesn't do is that something that is quite a female thing, which is like basically like that look for someone else to say the nice thing about you. Because you don't feel like you can say it yourself. She just says it herself.
Exactly. And that's why she's open. That's why people appreciate her. Like, if someone is the best at doing something or they're the number one, this, that, and the other, when they just say it plainly, factually, it doesn't sound braggy. But it's actually when people try and sort of play it down, humble brag it, that's when you're just like, oh, please. You know what I mean? So actually, using her voice as a way to sense test that is actually very helpful because it helps me stay honest. You know what I mean? Like, am I actually trying to low key say something cool about myself rather than just saying it? And if it sounds weird out of her mouth, then I go, yeah, you're just trying to humble brag it. Just say it.
What's your superpower?
I think it is listening to my heart.
That's a really good superpower.
Yeah, we out here trying. Yeah, just navigating by heart.
And last one, how many fucks did you give?
You know, not none. The art is finding the right things to give a fuck about, isn't it? It's like, and you know, the right opinions to give a fuck about. That's why I'm not on Twitter anymore.
Oh, man. That's a bad place to be. But it all boils down. It feels like so much of this conversation is boiled down to checking in with your heart and listening to it.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, when you make decisions based on that, sometimes to the outside world and even to your own logical brain, they don't make sense, but they make sense to your heart, and your heart never steers you wrong.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, you might also like the episode with Selena Godden, who wrote the book Andy Recommended. You'll find a link to it in the show notes. You can hear a new episode of The Shift each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, please do rate, review and follow, because it really does help other people find us. And if you'd like more of The Shift in your life, head over to theshiftwithsambaker.substack.com. www.thehyphenmagazine.com and sign up for weekly newsletters, podcast extras, and more.